Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Call it the kale of the sea, if you like, or macroalgae or sea vegetables, but most people just call it seaweed. And these ocean plants are getting a lot of attention these days. Local chefs say they love the complex taste seaweed brings to their dishes. Also, the plants contain an impressive amount of vitamins and minerals, and seaweed is cheap and easy to grow in our region. For all these reasons, researchers at UNH are now super enthusiastic about seaweed, saying that for healthier people, oceans, and coastal economies, kelp is on the way. Today in The Exchange, sorting out the hope from the hype about seaweed, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests in studio. Gabriella Brandt is with us, commercial fisheries specialist at UNH Sea Grant. And Gabby, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Michael Chambers, marine aquaculture specialist with the UNH School of Marine Science and Ocean Engineering. And Michael, welcome to you too. Thank you for your time.
Yes, good to be here.
Well, Gabby, seaweed has been a part of Asian cuisine for a long, long, long time, obviously. What's behind the new interest in seaweed eating here in just the broader American culture?
I think more of the global interest in Asian cuisine to begin with. You know, oh, I didn't realize that we could eat seaweeds, things like that. But I also think people are more interested in knowing where their food is coming from and the whole locavore movement and, you know, ooh, I can actually go foraging for my own seafood and seaweed. And I think people are just experimenting more with different flavors and things like that.
So the whole local foodie culture that we've really seen explode here in New Hampshire in the last 5 or 10 years, that's what this is a part of?
I believe so, yes, because everywhere you go, people are saying, well, where's my fish coming from? Where's my seafood coming from? And if you can see it right in your own, you know, I call it your sea garden. I think people really appreciate knowing exactly where it's coming from.
Well, and if people want to see a video of Gabby and some of her students collecting seaweed on the beach, you can go to our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange, and there's some videos, pictures of seaweed, also some recipes if you're feeling like trying it out. How much, Gabby, are we eating seaweed already in everyday grocery store products?
Amazingly enough, people are always surprised about that question. We actually eat it a lot. It's
really
pretty much in anything that you can think of that needs a little bit of extra oomph, like yogurts and ice creams and anything that would otherwise be a liquid if you didn't have a little bit. It's, you know, known as agar or carrageenan or anything like that. So it's in a lot of it's in your toothpaste.
So wait, carrageenan is seaweed?
Yes, it comes from Irish moss, which we have been using actually in New England for a really long time to make desserts with a little bit of milk and sugar or heavy cream, and you boil it, and it has its own thickening components. So it's been used a lot in that. Been doing it in New England for years and years and years.
Okay, so we learn something new every day. That's
a little
mine right there.
And
well, and so Michael, to you too, what do you think? Why this rising interest in seaweed?
I think there's many reasons. It's a wonderful product that's grown in an environment that has a lot of nutrients, and this product, it cleans the environment, and it's a product that's healthy for us to eat. Seaweeds is the biggest crop grown in the world right now, mostly in Asia, and a lot of that stays in Asia. Very little bit actually comes to the United States. But we're quickly learning the health aspects of it, and we're quickly learning how to grow it in our own waters here in our backyard, as Gabby had mentioned. So a lot of the work that we're doing at UNH is figuring out how best to grow these types of seaweeds, on what structures and what parts of the ocean, the seasonality of when to grow them. And then a big component then is, well, what do you do once you harvest that seaweed? How do you process it? Do you dehydrate it? Do you put it into a mix, or do you put it into kelp beer? And that's sort of the exciting aspects of what we're learning about today here in New Hampshire.
So it's a whole different type of aquaculture. We're used to hearing about fish farming, but you're working on seaweed farming.
Yes, in fact, we are. And then what we're actually doing in New Hampshire is doing a combination of all three. We grow seaweed, mussels, and steelhead trout together on a floating platform in Newcastle, New Hampshire. And the benefit of that is we have these lines, we call them dropper lines, that surround the fish cage. And these dropper lines, about 10 feet long, have mussels and kelp growing on them. And they act as a biological filter, and they encapture the waste products from the fish. So they take that nutrient out and help keep a healthier, cleaner ecosystem.
Yeah, that was one of the questions that I had was, I've read about how seaweed is a filter, a cleansing agent, and so forth. And I did wonder, Michael, you know, we're told not to eat too much tuna, for example, because the mercury concentrates in the fish and other types of fish. So if seaweed is a cleaner of the water, is it pulling in toxins and pollutants that we shouldn't eat?
It could pull in heavy metals, and therefore you wouldn't want to eat seaweed that's close to a commercial harbor, a wastewater treatment center. We do it more in the open ocean where the waters are much cleaner, just like an oyster or a clam. You don't want to take it from an area that is closed. There's areas that are open to shellfish harvest, areas that are closed. So it's highly regulated here, and we would be the same way as well.
So does seaweed sort of act like the liver, like cleansing out toxins from the body?
Things can be pulled into it that can be carried. The heavy metals is one that we would want to keep an eye on. We've had our seaweed analyzed, and we haven't seen any issues with it. Arsenic is another one that could be of concern, too. Again, in the analysis we've done, it's all been clean.
Well, a little bit later, maybe we'll talk more about the ecological benefits of seaweed, because it's real interesting. I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Seaweed as the new superfood. That's what we're learning about today on The Exchange. Lots of research going on at UNH, and we're finding out more. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments about eating seaweed. 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Gabby, I don't know if you wanted to jump in on the whole question of, you know, just like we're not supposed to eat certain types of fish every day, should we not be eating seaweed every day?
Yeah, actually, those are great points. In terms of the heavy metals, I just wanted to address that a little bit further in that, I get asked that question quite often. And what I usually say is it also depends in terms of how much content or the different types of heavy metals, where you harvest and what time of year, and whether it's after a rainstorm or things like that, because things either get concentrated or diluted. So some of the commercial industries, companies actually do have them tested quite regularly so that they do meet the requirements that, you know, are out there for seaweeds and fish and so on and so forth. And I also always tell people who come to my workshops is a little goes a long way. I don't know if you've even smelled anything that I brought in today, but it adds a lot of flavor and a lot of nutrients in a very small amount. So if you think about Asian cuisine, they eat a lot of seaweed pretty much every day. And they are not, you know, in any sort of toxic danger. But what is the research does show that some of the things that you need to be aware of is sort of too much iodine and things like that. And it's a great source for iodine, but you can lower the effects of it just by cooking it, boiling it, and things like that. And it's a big range.
And I want to let everybody know that Gabby brought in several types of seaweed. So we can put some pictures on Instagram for you. She's got a whole bucket of seaweed over there. What is the nutritional profile of seaweed, Gabby? Everything I read said it's great for you.
Yes, it is exactly what we call it, a superfood, a vitamin from the sea. And like you had mentioned, it basically absorbs everything in the environment. And you get everything you can possibly imagine that your body needs. And different doses and different species have different levels of it. So you can't just say all kelps have the exact same amount of nutrients, micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, etc. It depends on the species. But yeah, for the most part, anything you need for your body to succeed, it has.
Well, so what are the different types of seaweed, Michael? Because, people say seaweed, people say algae, people say kelp. I mean, what's the difference between all these different definitions?
Right. There's many different species in the Gulf of Maine. We focus on species that are readily easy to grow. Gabby does more foraging workshops where she explains all the different types of seaweeds. The ones that we focus on include sugar kelp, Alaria escalante, dulse, Irish moss, Gracilaria, and sea lettuce are the most common, other than some of the floating types of rockweeds that come on in. And those are quite popular for people to find on the beach. It's usually dried up. They take it, put it in a bag, they bring it back home, and they put it on their garden. But we're focused on the culture techniques and the Alaria and the sugar kelps. We can actually bring in tissue from a mature blade, spawn it in captivity, and then we can set those spores onto a string and let it grow out a little bit, and then we can take that seeded line and take it to the ocean, and we outplant it on other lines. And we can grow kelp from a very small size to about 9 feet in 8 months.
Wow. So it's very regenerative.
Correct.
It grows eagerly and easily.
Yes.
So you're taking these spores and then bringing them almost like seedlings.
Correct.
Onshore and then bringing them back out to your floating dock and farming basically underneath the ocean.
That's correct. And we're looking at ways that we can grow this horizontally and vertically and long lines and on floating platforms. So it's kind of exciting. And we pull in a lot of the students from UNH, and we have a course there called Tech 797. And we had a group of students that came and tried a floating kelp raft that was quite successful in growing the Alaria that we brought to Portsmouth Brewery to make the kelp beer this year.
Well, we'll talk a little bit later with the brewer who came up with kelp beer. What is your favorite dish with seaweed? Do you forage for seaweed? Do you have concerns about foraging with seaweed? Do some of your favorite restaurants work with seaweed? Give us a call. We're open to your questions and comments today at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Gabby, how do you get folks like me who might eat seaweed at a Japanese restaurant, but I'm not going to buy it and bring it home and cook it? How do you convince me to do otherwise? Because right now I'm feeling a little reluctant.
You come to my workshops. One of the things that we've started doing in conjunction with Evan Hennessy, who I think might be coming on later, is we started these workshops exactly for that reason, to start educating people about the multiple uses for seaweeds in your daily dietary regimen. And one of the things that we do is we go to his restaurant and we do the gourmet version of adding things in recipes. And then I tell people, if you have picky kids like I do, you put them in smoothies and grilled cheese sandwiches. And
do the smoothies taste salty?
Depends on how much you put in.
Yeah.
You know? And like all smoothies, you just play with it until you find that perfect flavor for you. And it's very customizable, I guess. And then I also take people outside. And we go to different accessible beaches here in New Hampshire, and we do seaweed identification, and we have people do a lot of textures and IDing and so on and so smelling them and so on, and giving them recipes and ideas of things that are really easy for them to try. It can't hurt you to take a little bit of kelp home, chop it up and put it in your salad, or put it in your oven and make kelp chips and things like that. And I think people are really starting to get that idea. Okay, I don't have to eat a lot. I just want to try it, see what it's like. And people love it. I get a lot of emails and other sort of comments. It's like, oh, I didn't know you could do that with it. And I went home with my kids and we made pudding and things like that. So It's just come on out. It's really nice time spending it out on the shore, you know, and seeing what you're going to eat next.
Well, I can imagine the stories your kids will tell when they're in college about my mom and what she made us do, go to the beach and get seaweed and eat it. That's awesome. What do you think, Michael? How do you sort of entice the reluctant seaweed eater?
It's a very good question. I haven't been successful with my kids yet. So I try to I dry it out. I put it into kind of like a small flake, and then I'll sprinkle it on something that we cook. And I don't tell them about it. But other than that, they don't. They'd rather eat other stuff. I think, as Gabby had mentioned, a kelp chip, I think, would be something I'd love to see.
Well, it's salty and crunchy,
all good. And be mass-produced, and you could have that in your cabinet instead of, you know, a Frito-Lay potato chip. And I think kids grew up with something like that, it might be much healthier for them.
What do Japanese kids eat? I mean, there must be some snack foods that they have in Japan that Japanese kids probably gobble up, right?
You can't imagine. If you travel overseas to these countries and you go into supermarkets, you'll see bags of all sorts of different seaweeds that are dried out in different formats that are added to other components. And it's everywhere. And it's just not in our culture yet.
Yet, despite the efforts at UNH, but it is growing. And I want to let everybody know that our producer, Jessica Hunt, made seaweed shortbread in honor of today's show. Michael's got a piece in front of them. We all had some this morning before the show. It was very good. So you can check out all sorts of pictures on our website at nhpr.org/exchange. You can give us a call, too, 1-800-892-6477. So both of you, maybe you first, Michael. What's the biggest potential for seaweed here in New Hampshire? I mean, what's the big hope besides people should eat it? It's really good for you. What's the sort of meta goal here?
Well, I think I kind of view the planet from outer space, and I look at this blue planet that's 70% ocean. And one of the things we do at UNH is look at ways to farm it. And to me, it's a big blue pasture. And I could see us having more of a blue farm than a green farm on shore. And we could grow large amounts of seaweed for many different things. And the first and most important is human consumption. But it's also really good for animals, for horses, for cows to eat. In fact, there's been some research done that shows that cows that eat different types of seaweeds, it reduces their methane that they produce.
Really?
It helps
clean
up the environment. It could also be used as biofuels. So one day maybe our cars could be run on seaweed. So many applications. And I think we're at the beginning of a research era where we're going to really learn a lot, and you'll see a lot of changes in the next 10 years.
Well, I love that analogy, a big blue pasture, and a pasture that you've had some success on a small scale in farming with your rafts and so forth. You described really about how it grows quickly and easily.
Correct. And there's a lot of farming going on in Maine right now as we speak. We do have two new mussel farms in New Hampshire, one by a fisherman, Jason Driscoll, and his daughter, Paige. They're lobster fishermen out of Rye, and they recently were able to get a kelp farm permit. And so this is their first year that they'll be growing kelp. We also have another one out at the Isle of Shoals, and we set some seed line out there this year. So we're really starting to reach out and try different species in different areas to see how well they do.
Okay, well, after a short break, Gabby, I definitely want your thoughts on that, too. The idea of a big blue pasture. Also, what's the ultimate goal when it comes to seaweed and seaweed farming? We should also talk, folks, about warming oceans and the impact on seaweed and seaweed farming. Also, whether it's possible to over farm naturally growing seaweed. And a little bit later, we'll talk to Evan Hennessy. He's a gourmet chef in Dover. He includes seaweed in a lot of his recipes, so we'll talk to him as well. All that plus your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Thank you.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, seaweed as superfood. Move over kale because there's rising interest in New England about the many benefits of seaweed for both human and, as we're hearing, environmental health. And while you're listening, check out our website. We've got links to recipes and some videos on farming and harvesting sea vegetables. Join us with your phone calls, questions, comments. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, before we go back to our listeners, Gabby, I did want to ask you the question that I asked Michael just before the break. You know, we talked about the health benefits of seaweed. We talked about Michael's experiments, seaweed farming. He talked about seaweed as a cleansing agent for the ocean. What's the big goal when it comes to this work that you're doing? What's the overall hope for seaweed?
I believe for at least in New Hampshire, the overall hope is to get, you know, some more sustainable seafood alternatives. As you know, in New England, we've been facing a lot of difficulties with our ground fisheries and so on and so forth. And if we can start having some sort of resilience plan for if and when anything happens to our commercial wild harvested fisheries, we have a backup plan. And I think for the amount of money and effort it would take to start farming our oceans a little bit, especially in the sustainable way that Michael is trying to do, I think it would give not just commercial fishermen, but you or me an opportunity to have a little bit more income if we can develop those markets and so on, especially if we're able to take advantage of the multiple uses of seaweeds, not just for food, but for human consumption, but for animal food, biofuels, and so on. It would be an amazing green boost to the economy, I think.
So to boost coastal economies here, yes, in New England, which have been struggling due to declining fish populations and regulations on fishing and so forth.
Yes, exactly.
Have you guys, either of you, talked to fishermen about how they feel about, you know, going from catching fish, which is kind of exciting, and, you know, there's the thrill of the chase and so forth, to farming seaweed? How do they feel about that?
I don't know. I'm mostly focusing on trying to get people to eat it to create, yeah, those markets.
Create the market first. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Create those markets and then, you know, ask our fishermen, hey, want to come in and join us in doing this. But Michael has had more experience,
yeah,
with that.
yes, we do have several fishermen. Isla Shoals Mariculture, which is Vinnie Perrin and Pete Flanagan. They have several offshore mussel leases where they're growing blue mussels. They recently just changed their lease to raise seaweed as well, too. So they want to do polyculture offshore. And then, of course, Jason Driscoll and his daughter Paige recently got a permit. So they're very open to farming the ocean. And we've done a lot of aquaculture research demonstration in New Hampshire. And part of that research, we try to bring in fishermen to help where they can, when they can, to utilize their vessels and their knowledge to help find the best site. We're not going to be growing things in the middle of their lobster grounds. We have had groups of fishermen that have trained on aquaculture in the past, and they, I think, view aquaculture as a positive thing. But while the fishing is good, they're going to continue to fish. And if the fishing changes, then they might come back and take a different look at actually growing something as opposed to taking it from the wild.
And when we talk about, you know, farming the ocean, and Michael, you know, probably know where I'm going with this. I mean, we have done some overfishing. There are certain stocks that are really in trouble. How do you avoid that happening with seaweed? I mean, if Gabby's efforts really take off and all of a sudden everybody wants seaweed for their gardens, for their animals, for themselves, how do we avoid just sort of, you know, ruining yet another underwater ecosystem?
That's a very good question. And from a Garawa perspective, I feel, and I have colleagues in Maine that feel the same way too, we can produce more seaweed than we know what to do with right now.
So you're talking more about growing it
growing
on your
seaweed,
own.
Yes.
Yeah.
From a foraging perspective, yes. If everybody started to migrate to the ocean today, and we have a very small coastline, you could take a lot more than you should. So we have to be careful of that. Seaweed can be very seasonal, though, too. Some of it that you might find might not be in the best shape or condition, so you might not want to eat it, but you could then take it, dry it, and put it on your garden as fertilizer.
Talk about that a little bit, Gabby, because, again, you run foraging workshops, how you avoid, you know, just stripping the beach bare so that the sea creatures don't have anything to eat.
Right. So that's one of our big important points when we take small groups out, you know, very small. I think the most we've had at one time is 15, and that's by design. And we also show them exactly what is the most sustainable way of foraging for these. We tell them, take only what you think you will need. So be conscious about, you know, your eyes get really big for your mouth.
Anybody who's picked strawberries or blueberries, guilty as charged. It's easy to just say, wow, and just grab everything.
Right, exactly. And so we really make that point. And then also, we show them exactly how you can do this sustainably, which is basically giving the different species of seaweeds a haircut so that it can regenerate from the tip out. So instead of pulling things off of the rock so that you kill the entire organism, you actually just cut some of the blades off and everything and leave enough for it to continue growing, because you do want to keep coming back and giving it another little, you know, trim, if you will. So we make a big point of showing people how to do it. And if you find it in the water and it looks like it's in great shape and nothing's growing on it, take that instead of taking the stuff off the rocks and things like that.
Okay, and that makes sense. Anybody who's grown lettuce can appreciate what you're saying.
Yeah.
About just snip it and it'll grow back.
Okay.
Let's go to our listeners, all of you. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Got a couple emails here too that I want to share with you. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Seaweed as superfood is the topic today in the exchange. And we'd love to get your questions, comments, personal experiences with incorporating seaweed in your diet. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Donna's calling from Meredith. Hi, Donna. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead, Donna.
So I'm calling in because I'm a whole foods nutritionist and cook, and I've been eating seaweed for over 30 years. And I find it very exciting that it's being grown in New Hampshire and that it's being, you know, people are being educated about this incredible food.
When you say you're a whole foods nutritionist, what does that mean exactly, Donna?
Well, I was actually trained by Michio and Aveline Kushi, who were the first Japanese people to come to the United States and teach about the benefits of seaweed. So I studied in Boston at the Kushi Institute for many years. About the effects of whole foods on the body and how, you know, what their healing benefits are and how to create balance.
All right. Well, Donna, thank you very much for calling in. And this relates to an email that we got from Connie in Stratum, who says, I began eating seaweed over 5 years ago as part of a post-cancer recovery program. Wow, Connie. She says, it is not only full of minerals, but I was told it also helps flush the toxins from radiation and chemo. Connie says, FYI, I order from a Maine distributor, and after the nuclear event in Japan, they had to ration because of the demand. So, Michael, this gets to what we talked about earlier. You do need to look at your seaweed and where it comes from, and you said that you test yours pretty carefully. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct. Absolutely. Yeah. You can't just take it from any place. But most of these seaweeds, they're marine seaweeds. They need to be out in clean, highly energetic water. And so you don't really find these up in the bay, Great Bay area. You actually have to go offshore. Isle of Shoals, for example, is a perfect area where many different types of seaweeds grow. You go up to Maine, you have this inundated coastline, so much water, fresh water coming in from the ocean. It's a combination of the energy and nutrients from nearshore that really make it grow quickly.
So the more out in the ocean seaweed, probably not worrying about too much. Seaweed close into shore, you got to kind of look.
You do. Yeah, if you're going to, close to a commercial harbor or industry in particular, a lot of those areas are typically closed down to any sort of aquaculture in general. So it wouldn't be wise to do it there.
And yet, isn't there hope, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, that the use of seaweed in these sort of, you know, bays and tidal rivers and so forth, coastal waterways, can help clean those waters? You wouldn't want to eat the seaweed, but they can be very beneficial.
Absolutely. A case in point would be a wastewater treatment center. If you could set up a small algae farm out near the outfall, you could take up a lot of the extra nutrients that come out from there. And then you could take those and, again, put them to fertilizer. Maybe you want to put them into some animal feeds, but you'd have to be careful, you know, as to what you use it for.
But at a bare minimum, that would help clean up the water?
Absolutely.
And is anybody doing that? It sounds so simple.
I don't know if anybody here locally. I'm sure people are thinking about it and maybe being done in other areas, but I think it's an area for a lot of research.
All right. Well, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Evan Hennessy is on the line. He's owner and chef at Stages at One Washington in Dover, where he forages for wild edibles, including seaweed. And Evan, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to talk with everybody this morning.
So what's some of your more popular seaweed dishes?
It's less directed at one dish and the fact that we use it kind of across the board in a lot of different things. And it's everything from drying to grinding to implementing in pretty much every stock that we make for the restaurant. And all the way through some of the things that Gabby mentioned before, you know, through using as a thickening agent versus sort of chemical or non-chemical additives.
So a stock meaning like a soup stock or a sauce stock, seaweed adds flavor and body and thickness to it?
Exactly. Depending on which seaweed we use, we'll give it either, just as you said, the body, the flavor, or the thickness. And we like to add that sort of that umami flavor, if you like, to kind of round out the complexity of each stock, whether it be anything from duck to pork to a vegetable stock or simply a straight-up seaweed stock. It gives it a whole other dimension of flavor to every one of our dishes.
It's the secret sauce of the sauce.
It's the secret sauce.
So
yeah,
you used a word that's used a lot in this conversation, but some people might not have heard of it, umami. Go ahead. What is that, Evan?
It's kind of an all-encompassing. I mean, if you think of all the different sort of parts of taste and whatnot that you experience when you try a flavor, it's kind of like, I guess, the next one that's all-encompassing. And it gets into the sort of the funky, nutty, soy, earthy. It's like kind of an everything sort of flavor. It's that, we always describe it, it's that flavor that makes you say, oh, wow, that's great.
Well, a little bit later, we'll talk with someone who has put that umami seaweed flavor into his beer. So we'll go there in about 10 minutes. But, you know, we talked earlier, Evan, about how Asian diets have long included seaweed. What other types of cuisine inspire you when you cook with this ingredient?
Actually, going back to it's a very historical American, in fact, New England, if you will, is how it was incorporated, because it was just simply used throughout, being that it was an ingredient that we had available to us. You know, whether it be used in curing fish or smoking, or, you know, all the way through to using in lobster bakes and crab bakes and clam bakes and things like that. So we definitely look to our own heritage to define our cuisine now. So we look far into our own history.
That's interesting.
Asian is definitely a big thing. Not to say that we sort of cook Asian flavors. A lot of people think that, you know, like they kind of try to push it in that direction. When you say it's like, oh, you're using seaweed, you know, do you cook sort of Japanese or Chinese or anything? Like, no, we cook New England, which is the way we like to describe our foods.
That's so interesting, because we think of, you know, native people here in New England and then the early white settlers as sort of eating, you know, wild turkey and wild deer.
Yeah.
But they ate seaweed.
They did. And also to the point that both Gabby and Michael mentioned is that, you know, use it as fertilizer for the gardens and everything. It was a very, you know, well-used resource. Then and obviously has since kind of faded and then turned into it's just Japanese and it's just nori and it's just, you know, kombu and things of that sort. But, you know, again, where I'm standing now, I'm not even 8 miles from the ocean, so it's right here.
You know, you talked about that secret sauce of umami and how inspiring it is for you, how yummy it is. Mm. What has not gone over as well, Evan, when you've tried to cook with seaweed? You know, what mistakes have you made where you made something and you went, not so good?
The gelatinous aspect. I can go right to it. And that simply plays out in a texture form, whereas we've played with the thickening power of seaweeds, and whether it be fresh or dried, and then you try to coagulate something by use of Irish moss, And all of a sudden, it looks like it's really good, and it's going to set as like a nice sort of a pudding texture, if you will. And then all of a sudden, it really sets, and you're like, that's kind of gross. And it becomes something you can't use. And, in the end, it never makes it to the dish. But that would be our mishap and our oops.
Well, you got to experiment, right? I mean, otherwise, you're not going to learn anything.
Absolutely, no.
Where do you get your seaweed, Evan?
Actually, the classes that that Gabby is hosting that I've been fortunate to be a part of, right around the Odeon area, there, because it's a great safe area. Is that we go off and go as far into the water as my little legs can take, and just as Gabby had said, is that we give the seaweed the haircut, and through our own research and also learning and talking with Michael and Gabby, is that we've learned to harvest responsibly. And also to the point that she was saying was that actually you were also mentioning before about not over harvesting. And Michael says that there's so much out there we necessarily could never really do it. But anytime that we forage, we always keep it in mind that we take only what we need, knowing that we can go back the next day should we need more. And so from there, we go right off in the waters and we look for good clean water and then the healthiness of the seaweed in general. And then from there, we kind of, we let the ocean inspire what our uses of the seaweed could be.
Well, Evan, it's been really good to talk to you and really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Evan Hennessy, owner and chef at Stages at One Washington. It's a restaurant in Dover. And as he told us, he uses a lot of seaweed in his dishes. You can join us with your comments and questions about the expanding interest in eating seaweed today in The Exchange. 1-800-892-6477. And Gabby and Michael, let's go right back to our listeners. Justin's on the line in Dover. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a quick question about how this harvesting could affect the carbon cycle. As I understand it, the ocean is a pretty significant carbon sink. And I'm wondering, is the scale that we're currently or expecting to harvest seaweed at essentially taking biomass out of the ocean to the point that it could negate some of the benefit of that carbon sink that the ocean is doing? Or are we at such a small scale that that's pretty much negligible?
Well, Justin, that is a great question. And Michael, I'll throw that to you. Real interesting point.
I think... if you look at Asia, for example, they've been growing seaweeds for hundreds of years, and they continually put the seaweed out, they continually harvest it and bring it back on in. I think a lot of what we see is not natural foraging. I think that's a very limited approach. We, in Maine especially, they do a lot of natural foraging. They actually have companies that are taking seaweed, harvesting seaweed just for fertilizers. And so there are new rules being put into place as to how much you can take. But yes, they are a great carbon sink. And I think we really need to be careful with how much we take and certainly look at a farming approach more so.
What do you think, Gabby?
I would tend to agree with Michael. I think, especially in New Hampshire, the scale that we're doing these things are very small, so I'm not entirely sure that it would even cause a blip in the carbon radar. But I do believe that we do need to follow Maine's example and really regulate if we ever get to that point. And that's one thing I want to emphasize. If we ever get to that point, just really regulate where it's coming from and how much you take.
Yeah, so right now, not so much to worry about. But if your efforts and the efforts of people in Maine and elsewhere are successful, then Justin's point is well taken?
Yes.
Okay, Justin, thank you very much for calling in. You can join us, too, after a short break. The number 1-800-892-6477. And coming up, we'll also talk to a guy in Portsmouth who used sugar kelp to make some beer. We'll hear about that. No tasting this morning, but we'll hear about it. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, seaweed as superfood. We're looking at rising interest in growing and eating seaweed here in New Hampshire and what to watch for as this trend expands. Join our conversation and check out our website for some great videos on harvesting seaweed, recipes using it, some of the experimentation going on at UNH. Our website is nhpr.org/exchange. The number for you to join us now is 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhprexchange. We've been talking to two UNH researchers, Gabriella Bratt, she's a commercial fisheries specialist at UNH Sea Grant, and Michael Chambers, marine aquaculture specialist with the UNH School of Marine Science and Ocean Engineering. We're joined now by Matt Gallagher. He's head brewer at Portsmouth Brewery. He created Selkie, a beer using sugar kelp, in conjunction with the folks at UNH. And Matt, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So, big question everybody listening wants to know, what did it taste like?
It tasted like a malty, sweet, pretty full-bodied Scottish-style red ale with a nice touch of brine and saltiness, kind of a balance on salty, sweet.
So we heard earlier from Evan Hennessy, the chef in Dover. He talked about umami, which I still haven't completely wrapped my head around, but that sort of fullness, that wow, that slightly salty, very flavorful kick, is that present in your beer?
Definitely, definitely. When you have a pint, you kind of feel like you're having more than just a beer. It's a fuller experience.
What gave you the idea, Matt, to put seaweed as an ingredient in beer? I mean, people make, you know, maple beer and blueberry beer and all sorts of other stuff.
Yep. I can't take credit for the idea. It was actually one of the owners of the Portsmouth Brewery, Joanne Francis. She had been traveling in Scotland quite a few years ago, and she had a beer that I believe was made with bladderwrack seaweed, and she was quite taken by it, and she sort of challenged me to start playing with it and using it. And beer's a pretty simple process, you know, four very simple ingredients. So anytime I have an opportunity to make it a little more exciting, a little more fun, learn something new, I'm all about it. So.
How important an ingredient is the seaweed, Matt? Is it a lot? Is it a little? I mean, I know you don't want to mess with too much with the fundamentals of beer making.
We use quite a bit, actually.
Really?
I have a seven-barrel brew system at the Portsmouth Brewery, and we put 60 pounds of kelp into that seven-barrel batch of beer. So it was a pretty substantial part of the flavor. We put it in with about a half hour left in the boil just to, you know, boil off and any sort of critters that might have been on there and to really extract some of the beneficial flavor and health qualities from it.
I'm wondering how the high salt content in seaweed and also the sort of gelatinous quality that Evan talked about, I'm wondering if that kind of mucked up the process at first or whether that was troublesome for you.
No, not really. I think the coagulating factors sort of added to the body of the beer, certainly. And really just that salty, briny quality came out just in the end, as you have the beer, as you experience it, as it crosses your palate, you kind of get just this really beautiful full-bodied sweetness. And then after you've finished your beer, you can lick your lips and you have like a little brininess clinging to your lips like when you get out of the ocean when you're a kid swimming. So.
And you have no desire to eat peanuts or chips?
No.
Along with your beer. You already got your salt there. How many iterations did you go through to get it right?
We got it right. I was really happy with the first batch, which we brewed last year. It was a tremendous success, and so we doubled the batch this year for the second time around. You know, the kelp's really only harvestable, which I've learned through Michael. Thankfully, he's come into my life, and when the water temperature is just right, you know, that's when we have to harvest. So we really can only make this beer once a year if we want to use the fresh stuff.
Oh, kind of like a Oktoberfest.
Yeah. And this time around, the first batch, we just used the sugar kelp exclusively. This year, Michael brought me three different varieties. He brought the Ilaria, the Dulce, and the sugar kelp. And we kind of diversified the species this year. And I felt we had achieved even more balance this year than the original. Yeah.
Hang on a second, Matt, if you could, please. Gabby, what did you learn from this whole thing? I mean, you talked earlier about how seaweed is part of this growing localvore movement here in New Hampshire that's been so successful. How did stretching out to beer kind of fold into the efforts that you're making?
Well, this is really a funny story because I had an intern right around the same time that Matt and Michael were talking. And we just both had this sort of epiphany, like, let's put it into the beer. And we
Why not?
And we were joking also in terms of, well, we could even market it as, you know, this is the healthy beer. There's no hangover. Because there are still a lot of nutritional benefits as well, you know, even if you're drinking it, in terms of it's not like he's boiling off all of the vitamins and minerals.
That's
and
what
so
I was wondering, because if you boil, probably if you boil anything for too long, you lose most of the nutrition.
Right. And so, I mean, it was probably a little bit of a gimmick, but we did think that it would be great to diversify the types of seaweeds that we would use. And it just so happens that they got it out on tap, you know, quicker than we had gotten around to interviewing people and saying, can you try it? But that's definitely a market we want to pursue. There's a lot of microbreweries around here that we would love to you know, hey, you guys want to try some Dulse or some Gracilaria or different flavors? So I think it would be a great market to explore further.
And, you know, Michael, Matt mentioned something that I think you mentioned earlier, that seaweed actually has a season. Now, of course, you know, anybody who has a backyard garden knows that there's seasons for certain plants. But I never even thought about seaweed having a season. What are the seasons of seaweed?
Typically, you would outplant in the early winter, say December or even late fall, and have it go for about 6 months to 8 months. We've been able to play with it where we actually put it out in the spring.
And when you say put it out, you mean, just remind us.
The seed line. You would outplant the seed line into the ocean, and you give it 6 months. It likes the cold water. During the cold water seasons, the winter seasons, you don't have as much epiphytes, organisms that might attach and grow onto it, that kind of ruin the quality and flavor to it. So we want a clean product, which is what we get in the spring. When we get into the summertime, it gets too warm, and then we have lots of things that are growing on it. A lot of animals start to chew on it, so it doesn't have the quality. So we like to harvest it all before July 1st, if we can.
You know, we're talking about the cold waters. We really should talk about warming oceans. We hear especially that the Gulf of Maine is warming. What impact is this having on the seaweed that you're trying to grow, Michael?
We are concerned with that. We are very lucky to be north of Cape Cod, and it puts us in an area called the Gulf of Maine. And our waters here are much cooler than south of Cape Cod. So we have a little bit of protection, but that could all change in the next 5-10 years. We see even with lobsters, with the warming temperatures, the lobsters are moving further offshore into deeper waters where it's colder. So for kelp, maybe we'll have to move further offshore to grow it if they continue to warm up.
Well, here's an email from Dave in Greenland who says, I have heard that kelp forests in the Gulf of Maine were disappearing and being replaced by a different, possibly invasive seaweed. Can your guests speak to this? Is that Michael, Gabby, either of you want to tackle that one?
We can both, I guess.
Sure.
I'll go first. Our colleague Jennifer Dykstra did the research out in the Isles of Shoals, and it is an invasive from Asia, and it's basically a very fibrous type of seaweed, and it just basically covers everything, outcompetes things, and it also has a season, so the warming temperatures do make it grow a little bit faster. And you've seen it on the beaches on the last several years. It's that really hot, well, it's not hot pink. I guess it's like Pepto-Bismol pink. And it creates these really thick mats on the shoreline. And sometimes it's very difficult to remove. And people don't like it. It smells badly when it starts to rot and stuff like that.
So this is not a helpful invasive.
It is not helpful.
It's crowding out local plants like we see on land and in the fresh waterways here in New Hampshire. Because whenever someone talks about an invasive and how powerful they are, how quickly they can take over, I often think, okay, can we use this, you know, harm to some good? Mm-hmm. Could this be the next, you know, fuel that gets us to Mars? I don't know. But it sounds like for right now, no.
No, I talked to Jen actually a little bit about it. She said it was sort of started coming in 2010. And I said, well, can we eat it?
Yeah, of course. first question.
My very first question. She's like, well, I'm not really sure, she said. But she says that urchins and other little sea critters seem to avoid it. So we're not,
it's not native.
It's not native, and we're not entirely sure. So there's definitely some research questions to be investigated there. It's also very fibrous. So it might not actually be good to put in foodstuffs and things like that. But there's a lot of possibilities to study it, for sure.
Well, I'm really glad that you emailed Dave, because invasives, I think, is definitely a problem with freshwater plants and on land. And I have not looked at the seaweed, the ocean invasives. So I'd love your thoughts too there, Michael, please.
Yeah. We do have some other species that are coming in further south too, along the eastern seaboard. One species from Japan that's here now that wasn't before. So we're keeping an eye on that one as well. But yeah, it is a major concern. And unfortunately, a lot of the shipping traffic that comes into these areas bring in water, ballast water that has things in it that when they release that ballast water, once they get it, releases all these organisms into our environment. So I know there's a lot of controls on that, and we need to do a better job than we are to control some of that where we can.
Well, again, thank you for the email. And Matt, just to wrap up with you, so you talked earlier about your efforts to put seaweed in beer. You used sugar kelp. What are your future plans, Matt, for working with seaweed, if any? Maybe you're good right now.
Yeah, we're going to continue to make Selkie every year. It'll be an annual release, and that's really my only plan so far.
All right. Well, we'll have to give it a try for sure.
Yeah, and you know, I have to note that Irish moss has been used in beer. I mean, every brewer basically uses Irish moss as a kettle coagulant. So that's sort of a standard and always in there, bringing some clarity to the beer. And it's just never been used as a flavor agent before.
Well, and it kind of gets to what Gabby said earlier, that seaweed is more present than we realize. Matt, it was really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That's Matt Gallagher, head brewer at Portsmouth Brewery. He created, as we heard, Selkie, a beer using sugar kelp, in conjunction with the folks at UNH. Couple more last questions for you, Gabby and Michael. Here's one from Tony, who says, with your current show on seaweed, I believe your show is understating the relevance of seaweed in Western culture. Tony says, for instance, in Ireland, kelp as a food supplement, especially on the West Coast, has a long history. The kelp was used in agriculture as a natural fertilizer, giving it back to the food cycle. Tony says, in literature, later in film, seaweed was a prop in the opening scene of The Field by John B. Keane. Wow, Tony. Thank you. Go ahead, Gabby. I'd love your thoughts there.
Oh, yes. So that is a really good point, and something that I was sort of trying to get to as well, is that it's not really a new resurgence of the seaweeds in North America. I mean, it's been in our culture, as Evan had said, for hundreds of years, and it's just getting a resurgence on it. And he's absolutely right. They're used for everything from medicinal purposes to food to beauty products and so on.
Well, and you and Michael have to get together and watch that movie now,
yes.
The Field by John B. Keane. Thank you so much for the email, Tony. Back to the calls, and Tim is from Campton. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, thank you very much. How
sure.
are you today?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to share something there talking about the history thing. I'm from a Rhode Island family that we've been in Rhode Island since 1639, and our property there is a King's Grant from King Charles. And in our original grant, we are given the right to collect seaweed, specifically on a certain area of the seacoast down there. And, you know, as a child and, growing up with one of my chores with me and my brothers was collecting seaweed after a moon tide. It would push the seaweed would all get pushed up on a rack line. And we'd go down and collect the seaweed and bring it up to spread it on the fields for the,
wow.
for the hay fields to fertilize the hay fields. And we used to go down with the trucks, and, you know, it was a real treat for, 12, 13-year-old kid to be in a go down there and drive the truck down the beach, and would be forking, using pitchforks and picking the seaweed up. And the other thing that we used to do is there's a trap fisherman down there. And the fish traps are, just big net weirs that are set out off the coast there and are left in for months at a time. And when they pull those nets out, they want to dry them out so they don't rot. And they would spread them out on the fields up there. And all the farmers in the area would, allow the fishermen to dry their nets out on the fields because they would be completely encrusted in seaweed, which would then, dry up on the nets and fertilize their fields, fall off and fertilize their fields. And you could actually see the impressions of the nets, the lines of the nets in the field as the grass greened up you could see the shape of nets and green on the fields because of the benefits of the seaweed, you know.
So, Tim, the deed to your property back 1639, is that what you said?
Yeah, 1639. Yeah.
So it just shows you how long seaweed has been important, as our earlier emailer, Tony said.
The beach rights down there were given, and in Rhode Island, I don't know about New Hampshire. I moved up here in 2004, kind of semi-retired, and you know, I'm pretty much retired now. But the whole seaweed collection thing, it wasn't unique to just any one person. There's actually there's what are called breezeways in Rhode Island, which are accesses to the ocean for the express purpose of the common people to be able to access the shoreline and collect seaweed and also to collect sand and stone for building.
Shows you how important it was. And Tim, in the interest of time, I got to let you go. I do apologize, but we have to wrap up. I'm struck by this call, Gabby. Thank you so much, Tim. It just shows you how important seaweed has been here in New England for so long.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the uses for it is not, like I said, not just nutritional benefits to us humans, but to animals, to your crops, to your gardens. They're used for so many other things. People build furniture and they build roofs and things like that. All over the world, there's so much. We could have 10 shows about seaweeds, I swear. but absolutely, there is a long history, absolutely, in North America.
Well, it kind of gets back to what Evan Hennessy said. You know, people come to his restaurant and they say, oh, you're serving seaweed. This must be Japanese or Asian cuisine. And he says, no, no, it's New England cuisine. Mm-hmm. So the call from Tim and the email from Tony remind us of that. And speaking of animals, here's an email from Gregory who says, I've seen sheep grazing on seaweed during low tide during the winter on the island of North Haven, Maine. Pretty sure that practice is used in coastal communities during the winter when the grasses are not readily available. And I think both of you talked earlier about livestock feeding on seaweed instead of grain. So thank you for the email, Greg. Both of you, thank you so much. And I want to let everybody know that there are videos of Michael doing his seaweed farming out in the ocean and Gabby doing her seaweed foraging on the coast on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, including some recipes if you want to experiment a little bit. Gabby and Michael, thank you so much. It was really nice to meet you.
Thanks for
Great
having
to
us.
Be here.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Christina Phillips and Jessica Hunt. And again, Jessica put up a lot of resources on the website, so check it out. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.